It's not. God didn't write the Bible so that only intellectual giants could comprehend what it meant. So when it says of Christ that the common people heard him gladly, it means that they fully comprehended and understood what Christ was saying. And we're all common people. You know, as humanists would tell us, every one of you is absolutely unique, just like a billion other people. And in terms of that unique commonality that we all have, we believe that the Father has written his word in such a way that good and honest hearts can comprehend it, but at the centre of good Bible study is being able to read it well. And I think that good Bible reading is very much about reading with the proper emphasis. So I was going to use this tomorrow, but I'll use it tonight because it's a good example. And if you've heard this one before, I apologise. But in the 1 Samuel chapter 3, so I'm just going to give this one to you as an illustration. And then we're going to come round the group. Now, incidentally, we're going to do this again tomorrow night. So we're going to have this as a session both nights. Our sort of last night, the end of the night session is another episode for good reading. And we're going to have people come up and do it. And so just looking at the tables, I would think by calculation, we've got about 14 or maybe 15 tables of four, or in some cases slightly less. And so if we can get through maybe six or seven readings tonight and another six or seven tomorrow night, hopefully everyone will have had the chance, at least one per table will have had the chance to do a reading, and every table will have had the chance to contribute a reading to be read as part of the exercise. And what I want you to do in terms of these readings is to read emphatically but not dramatically. Now, do you understand the difference? The difference is that not every Bible passage is dramatic, but every Bible passage will have a proper emphasis which will help to make the Bible passage come alive as to its meaning. And it's astonishing how different emphasis can change the nature of a verse. So here's an example. 1 Samuel chapter 3. Now, you remember the story. Samuel, it says in verse 5 of 1 Samuel 3, ran to Eli and said, Here am I, for thou callest me. And he said, I called not, lie down again. He went and lay down, and Yahweh called yet again, Samuel. And Samuel arose and went to Eli and said, Here am I, for thou didst call me. And he said, I called not, my son, lie down again. Now, Samuel did not yet know Yahweh, neither was the word of Yahweh yet revealed unto him. And now we come to the verse we're going to read. And Yahweh called Samuel again the third time, and he arose and went to Eli and said, Here am I, for thou didst call me. And Eli perceived that Yahweh had called the child. Now, the only bit I'm going to read is the last sentence, and Eli perceived that Yahweh had called the child. So you ready? So none of this will be dramatic, but it will all be emphatic. And I want you to see how the sense changes. Which one of these do you think is the right emphasis of the reading? And Eli perceived that Yahweh had called the child. Well, that could be true, but then it would be pretty obvious that it was only Eli that could perceive, because the little boy is talking to Eli, and Eli is the only other person in the room. And so when it says that Eli perceived that Yahweh had spoken to the child, it is a truth, but it's probably not the vital truth, because it's self-evident that Eli would know that. So no, I don't think that's the correct emphasis to you. Excellent, we're in fellowship. How about this one? And Eli perceived that Yahweh had called the child. Well, that could be right. But then Eli perceived that Yahweh had called the child. It really just means that he figured it out, he knew. And somehow you don't intrinsically feel that that's where the climax of the sentence sits in terms of some astonishing truth that otherwise we would never have understood if we hadn't emphasised the word perceived. So whilst it's true that Eli did perceive, I don't feel that that's probably where the emphasis is taking us. Would you? No, I don't think so either. What about this one? And Eli perceived that Yahweh had called the child. Ooh, now that's interesting, isn't it? Because it could be that, couldn't it? That Eli perceived that Yahweh had called the child. Eli certainly knew it wasn't himself. He said three times, not me. And suddenly Eli's thinking, well, if it wasn't me, who was it? And suddenly it says, and Eli perceived that Yahweh had called the child. Ooh, yes, that's a distinct possibility. Don't you think, in terms of the emphasis? Could be that that was the blinding revelation that Eli had at this particular moment of time. Finally woken up in the middle of the night and trying to figure this out. Yahweh's called the child. Yes, I think we'd keep that one in reserve. Shall we do that? Excellent. How about this one? And Eli perceived that Yahweh had called the child. Here am I, for thou callest me. And he said, no, I called not. And so to say after three of those occasions and Eli perceived that Yahweh had called the child doesn't seem to be where the emphasis would naturally lie. Again, it's pretty obvious, isn't it? Self-evident. So now would you like to hear the right one? And Eli perceived that Yahweh had called the child. Who was Eli? He was the high priest, the channel of divine communication to Israel. And on that night, the high priest, who was the very medium of Yahweh's communication to his people, was bypassed. And God spoke to a little boy. And Eli knew on that night that the judgment of God had come upon him. And God had bypassed him. And as a channel of communication, he would no longer work through the high priest. And sure enough, the next morning, is it not true that the little boy gets up and tells Eli that his house was to be judged by God? True? Now, I think that's the proper reading. And when you actually put the record together, you suddenly realize that that is distinctly what the right reading should be, that the earth-shattering discovery that Eli made was not that Yahweh had called the child, but that Yahweh had called the child, and not him. And on that day, he knew that his role in the nation was forever changed. Now, you see how just changing what we emphasize can totally alter what the meaning of a verse might be or a sentence might be. It's all to do with reading with good emphasis. Did we need to look up any Hebrew words? Did we need to look at any cross-references? Sometimes we do, of course, for both of those things. But on this occasion, all we needed to do was to read carefully what it said and read it well. Good Bible study is based on good Bible reading. So let's start with some reading, shall we? Now, we could have it one of two ways. We could have it that a table chooses a passage and someone from another table must volunteer. Or we could have it that a table chooses a passage and then will choose their own volunteer from amongst their own selves whether they shall read the said passage. What thinkest thou? Any choices at all? What's that? Option two. All those in favour of option two? One table chooses the passage. The table immediately behind them, working around in a circular motion, will read the passage. Works for me. So starting at the start here. Right? That's good. No, we'll actually go in a snake. We'll actually snake our way right through the tables, you know, and we'll go from the back there to the back over there, and then don't worry, we'll figure it out. And don't forget, we're only going to get halfway through the room tonight before we call a halt, because remember, there are cups of tea and coffee for all six people who've ordered them at 10 o'clock tonight, coming up fast. So, gentlemen, on the front road. Do you have a passage by mutual consent?
We do.
Excellent. So give us the passage.
Psalm 69.
Psalm 69.
Verse 16 to 20.
Psalm 69, verses 16 to 20. Psalm 69, verses 16 to 20. Okay, so this is interesting because now in spirit we're at the crucifixion of Christ. Okay, good choice. So now the table immediately behind you, so we'll take this table here. So, gentlemen, you must choose a reader. Now, remember, I want you all to have a look at the reading. We're going to allow the reader another couple of minutes to read for the benefit of understanding his passage. And then remember, what we're going to do is bring the reader up here. How delightful. And the reader is going to read. And then we're going to just have comments, and I'm going to choreograph your comments so that they are essentially positive. But the real thing I'm going to ask you to comment on is this. Do you think that the reader read with good emphasis? Not good drama, but good emphasis. And for the reader, I want you to say to yourself, I am going to try and read this with the best emphasis I can to bring the meaning of the verses alive. So do we have a volunteer? Okay, excellent. Would you like to come forward, please? Yes. 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 So you're thinking of a comment you can make that's positive. If you feel that there is a, go and stand at the lectern, because then you can put your Bible down, and the light shines upon the page. And so now we'll read it together with him. But the reader is going to lead us in the reading, and it starts now.
Psalm 69, verses 16 to 19.
Good so far, don't you think? Yep. Happy with that? Yep. Excellent.
Verse 20.
Yep.
Hear me, O Yahweh, for thy loving kindness is good. Turn unto me according to the multitude of thy tender mercies, and hide not thy face from thy servant, for I am in trouble. Hear me speedily. Draw nigh unto my soul, and redeem it. Deliver me because of mine enemies. Thou hast known my reproach, and my shame, and my dishonour. Mine adversaries are all before thee. Reproach hath broken my heart, and I am full of heaviness. And I looked for some to take pity, but there was none. And for comforters, but I found none.
Okay, thank you. It's always difficult being the first reader on the block. So, gentlemen, any comments concerning our first reading? And I'm going to say concerning the first reading rather than the reader. So let's focus on the reading and, in that sense, disconnect ourselves from the reader per se. Yes? Right, so it wasn't rushed,
yeah.
Was measured. So that's a good aspect of reading. Part of good emphasis is to be measured. Yes, good comment. Any other comments?
Just a question.
Yep.
Did you get to read it before you got up and read it?
Very briefly.
Were you going to say that you could tell that he hadn't been... I could tell you hadn't given a lot of thought to that. That's right. Yeah. That's right. Okay.
It was clear?
Yeah, it was clear. Good. Yes.
I like the emphasis on the attributes of God.
Yep, so it was a focus on the Father in terms of picking up the word there. Yes?
Just simply knowing that, see, Christ's whole purpose was to direct us to the Father and giving everything to the Father, and he brought that out.
Yep, so there was a God-centered focus in the reading. Yes?
Yeah, I wonder if, I think Oh, definitely. But is it more the emphasis on, instead of thy mercies, thy mercy?
So any comments on that? Thy mercy versus thy mercy. What do you think? Any comments on that? What does the reader think now that he's heard Richard's erudite comment?
In verse 16.
Yes.
I just noticed there's a lot of thy and me.
Mm-hmm.
It would connect the characteristic more with God to put them together with that emphasis.
So what that's saying is there would be room to emphasize thy and mercies and not necessarily one at the expense of the other. So how would you do that? Could you read that for us? So if you just read the last part of verse 16 but emphasized thy tender mercies, all three words, how would that sound?
Turn unto me according to the multitude of thy tender mercies.
Oh, yes, I like the sound of that. Do you like that? Now, you see, notice how that by adding that, you didn't detract from the thy. Did you notice that? The thy was still there, but the tender mercies has now come to the foreground. Now, think about this. Where is Christ in the psalm? He's at the climax of the crucifixion. His need is desperate. His need is real. So don't you think he would say, turn unto me according to the multitude of, and you would expect him to say, thy tender mercies. You'd hear all of that, wouldn't you? And maybe even a cry in the way that he's saying, a slight sense of the fact that this one is crying for the tender mercies of God. So it's interesting that emphasizing one word can sometimes be right, like when I read it, the child. But on this occasion, thy tender mercies might, with due regard, be all emphasized without losing the thy. But what the Lord needed was the tender mercies of his God. So, yep, good comment. So, any other comments about that passage as a whole? Yes. Yep, I agree with that. And one other thought, just while we're here, is that, and I'm agreeing with something that's been said, and then I'm going to disagree with it for you to contemplate, is that while on the one side it's good to be measured, and I think that measurement is good, we don't ever want to feel that a reading is rushed. And you didn't feel that reading was rushed, did you? But one thing you can do whilst not rushing is to have a sense of ebb and flow. So when we talk about ebb and flow, what do we mean? We're changing the momentum of the reading, and it may flow backwards and forwards a little in terms of its velocity. So if we take an example, verse 19, so we could read, thou hast known my reproach and my shame and my dishonor. And then I ask you, do you think that's how Christ would have said it? Do you think that's how Christ would have spoken to the Father? If we were reading this as Christ speaking to the Father, would he say it in that measured way? And the answer is, I don't think so. But how would he say it? There would be a natural ebb and flow, wouldn't there, of something like, thou hast known my reproach and my shame and my dishonor. And you'd feel those three things cascading over the top of each other, rather, my reproach and my shame. He's not reading a list. It's like a cascade of things that add on top of one another. And, of course, the Father knew all of those things. So there is a sense that sometimes you can ebb and flow in a reading, and that will is I looked for some to take pity, but there was none. And that word none has to sound as if you understand the Lord's loneliness at that moment. The word none means that, doesn't it? He was desperately lonely. I looked for some, but there was none. And for comforters, but I found none. And that was part of the desolation of the Lord, is the desperate sense of loneliness that he had, and particularly at the climax of the crucifixion. He was all alone. And so ebb and flow is also part of good emphasis. So isn't it interesting how that when we start with thinking about emphasis, we think of emphasizing a particular word. And that's my fault, because I started with an example that did that. But emphasis could be altering the speed of the passage. That's another form of emphasis. That rhythm of some words cascading on top of each other versus something where there's a pause. And there were several pauses that you had in your reading that were good because they broke the reading up in that way. So pause is excellent in terms of emphasis. Emphasis is not simply about saying one word out loud. So I think that was a pretty good start, don't you? So thank you for that contribution. And you now get to pick the verse that someone behind you must read. So I presume that you, has your group selected a verse?
Job 38, verses 1 to 4.
Oh, Job 38, that sounds interesting. All right, so let's have a look at that one. So Job 38, 1 to 4. Now that was a baptism of fire, wasn't it?
Woo.
Exactly, that's right. The last read is going to be unbelievably good. Believe me, just wait and see. Okay, so Job 38 verses 1 to 4. Excellent. And who's our reader? Okay, you're right. That's pretty kind of you. That's right. Somehow there are some tables where suddenly everyone's very, very busy. By the way, the thing is, we all learn from each other with regard to readers because, you know, even though I've said there is a right way of reading and a wrong way of reading, sometimes two different readers can read the same passage and both of them are different. You think, actually, they were both really interesting. So, you know, just please bear in mind that there is no perfect way of reading. But learning to read with good emphasis is something I think we could all improve at, and it's a really good part of Bible study. So here we go, Job 38, verses 1 to 4.
Then Yahweh answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, Who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up now thy loins like a man, for I will demand of thee, and answer thou me. Wherefore wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding.
Okay, excellent. Now that's an interesting chapter, isn't it? Is there a capability of reading with emphasis in these verses? Oh, yes, I think so. So, any comments? Anyone like to offer a praise sandwich to our reader?
He's got a good, strong voice.
A good, strong voice, yes. By the way, that's really important, is both in reading and sometimes in prayers, a person will come to the front and they'll read, you know, the verse and you imagine that everyone must be able to hear what you're saying, but actually they can't hear beyond about the second row because for some reason you have failed to understand that you're reading in front of a large audience of people and actually 200 people can't really hear if you speak at that level. And have you ever had that happen? And sometimes people are utterly unaware of the spatial dimension of the room they're in and the audience that are trying to listen to them. So it was a good, clear reading. And the volume level was good. Good public reading. And I'm thinking, you know, public reading here more than, you know, he wouldn't need to be that loud in the confines of his own private study, although he might want to be, you know. you know. But for purposes of an audience, that was good, wasn't it? Yep, so yep. Another comment?
In this case, I know you said we're reading with emphasis, not drama, but in this case, there's definitely drama.
Oh, yes, there is.
And that was brought out in the reading.
And did he read with drama? Yes, I think absolutely so. And And as we've said, this is an appropriate occasion where drama is very much part of the record, because it's almost as if Yahweh is setting a court scene, isn't he? He's calling Job to the court of his own justice and saying, all right, now that phrase in verse 4. Yes, Richard?
Yeah, it's like a challenge. So I think Joel emphasized the pronouns you, where were you, and, you know, that sort of thing.
Yep.
It's like a challenge of Yahweh to this.
Yes.
And
you could read it two ways, couldn't you? Where was thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Is that the way our reader read it? Or you could read, where was thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Or you could read, where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? And by the way, they would all be true readings, wouldn't they? But the emphasis was different. See? So emphasis is an interesting thing, and so that's why I must stress it. I don't think there's any one right emphasis, but you can at least see how that changing the emphasis. Now, how did you read it? Would you like to read that verse again? So let's hear the original. Let's hear the original version again. Verse 4.
Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding.
Now that was the original version, right? And perfectly acceptable, right? And so clearly that sense of challenge from God, was that present in that reading? Whereas if you said, where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth, declare if thou hast understanding, you'd say, no, that is not a good reading. You ever heard that sort of reading? That's not a good reading. It won't be the precursor to good Bible study either. Because no sense of the drama or passion or power of that controversy was made known by the way in which it was read. By the way, an interesting thing with regard to personal Bible study, I know we're talking here about reading perhaps in the sense of reading at the meeting, but I always do my Bible study in my room by reading out loud when I'm reading a passage. Always read out loud. Because that sense of the subtlety and the nuance of the passage, you can't get by reading silently. You've got to read it out loud. And sometimes Paulie will go past my room and think that there's a slightly batty gentleman in there because I'm declaiming, you know, whatever it is that's being said. But it's how we get to grips with the passage. Anyone else like to add a comment before we release our speaker? Yes?
There was a good change of tone between the narrative and the words of God.
Yes, exactly. So there was a... And by the way, that whether that was done consciously or unconsciously by you, were you conscious of that? It's a very good comment you make, because it's one of the hardest things to do is to read something in a verse where God's speaking. How do I sound like God? So any thoughts on that? How do you sound like God? What preferred mode would you adopt?
Authoritative.
What else would you try and convey? Yes? Yes.
So the audience understands what's happening.
Yes. I don't know whether this is the right thing to say, but I have a feeling which sounds very postmodern, doesn't it? Because I can't put a scripture to this, you see, so I have to confess it's personal reasoning. But somehow I think that when we're reading a passage that's God speaking, that we're better not to project too much human emotion into that, because what we're then doing is putting a human emotional construct on how the deity thinks and acts and speaks. So I think there's a careful dance that you can dance whereby you can, by, I'm not even saying whether dropping the voice is quite right, but maybe just slightly lower and slightly sterner and slightly more majestic if that's possible, but not with a whole lot of emotion. For example, imagine this, verse 2. So here's Yahweh answers Job and he says, who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? Now, is that to be preferred to, who is this that darkeneth counsel with words by out, not without? Would you read like that for God? No, I don't think you want to convey that emotional sense that we might feel as humans. We don't know actually how God feels. So I would prefer to read the voice of God in as majestic and measured a way as possible, but with a sense of the emotion taken out of it, which leaves it sounding like God might say, but without actually projecting our own human emotions on that. It's only a personal feeling, and you may have a different view.
I think the punctuation is helpful too.
Yes.
Now, I don't know, but I think I picked up with that last verse you just read. You read the last sentence differently the first time than the way you did the second time. Because I think the first time you said, declare if thou hast understanding. But the second time you said, declare if thou hast understanding. Which could put a completely different emphasis on that section of the verse. Because God is saying, declare if thou hast understanding.
That's right. If you know, say.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
But the comma makes a big difference there.
Yes, that's right. Declare if thou hast understanding. So everyone familiar with what Matthew's saying? Declare if thou hast understanding has lost the force of the comma. So declare, pause, if thou hast understanding, is the challenge of God, and the comma helps to identify that. I think you read that very well, by the way. Excellent comma. Excellent good reading of the comma. Now, by the way, there's a lesson to that, because I have seen people that will go, I have seen people that have somehow a tendency to see that both colons and semicolons are a secret code to press on without delay. You ever had that? And so they read right over the top of a colon and right over the top of a semicolon, and frequently it sounds nonsensical because, by the way, the colon's there to actually say stop, not hurry on. So just think about that when you see a colon. That's a warning for you to just take a step back, regroup, and then come back in again. Probably not quite that long, but you know what I'm saying. Excellent, thank you. Good reading from Job 38. Good choice of reading. Good reader. And a final comment. Yes? Oops.
In reference to the punctuation in the English.
Yes.
How accurate do you think the translators are?
Well, we wouldn't take the commas and the colons and the as inspired.
No.
But I guess we would two things. We would take the particularly the authorized version that we use, and most modern translations, as trying to be true to the original Bible text, and therefore where they think a comma is correct in terms of the emphasis of the Hebrew, the comma will be inserted to try and give that sense. And this is a good example, as clearly that probably if we looked at the Hebrew, it doesn't say declare if thou hast understanding. The Hebrew probably says declare if thou hast understanding would be probably how the Hebrew would naturally read. So to make that read that way in the English, they've put a comma in to make that happen. So generally, I think the translators sought to be true to the idiom of the original the original passage. But the second way of verifying that would be to check it out in the Hebrew, if you wanted to check, is to read something like Rotahims and actually validate the emphasis from the text itself to see whether that was so.
How would you do that?
How would you do what?
Check the Hebrew.
What I said was you could use something like Rotahims, which is very much focused on, it's called the emphasized Bible because it seeks to take the original Hebrew and to give that the proper emphasis in the English tongue. So that would be a good way to start. You could check the Hebrew as well in terms of it's to do with the construction of the words. So, yes. Okay, so what does Rotahim say, by the way, for verse 4?
Tell, and then they note that the comma should provide emphasis to that first word.
Yes.
If thou hast understanding, because it's the same, just tell instead of declare.
Yep.
They are ending the word understanding
with
an exclamation mark.
Good. Yep.
Or if thou knowest understanding.
Yes, good. That's correct. So one of the problems with an electronic version of Rotahims is you don't know how to put the emphasis on the right syllable. Do we have a choice of reading for those learned gentlemen behind you?
Sure, let's go with Acts chapter 4, verses 7 to
12. Acts 4, verses 7 to 12. Now, what were the verses again?
Acts chapter 4, verses 7 to 12.
Okay. Oh, Jay, how are you?
How are you, Brother Roger?
Welcome.
Thank you.
All right, so should we give them a chance to have a quick read? All right, one more run through, just silently. Sorry, you can't read out loud for practice this time. But
7 to 12, you say?
Mm-hmm. It's very kind.
Okay, Acts chapter 4, verses 7 through 12. And when they had set them in the midst, they asked, "By what power or by what name have you done this?" Then Peter, filled with the Holy Spirit, said unto them, "Ye rulers of the people and elders of Israel, if we this day be examined of the good deed done to the impotent man, by what means he is made whole, be it known unto you all, and to all the people of Israel, that by the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, whom ye crucified, whom God raised from the dead, even by him doth this man stand here before you whole. This is the stone which was set at naught of you builders, which has become the head of the corner. Neither is there salvation in any other, for there is none other name under heaven given among men whereby we must be saved."
Good passage, don't you think? Mm. Acts chapter 4. Whoa, that's a beauty. So any comments upon the reading thereof? Yep. Yep. And there's a interesting thought here, isn't there? Is because you see, Christ has already quoted Psalm 118 to them in Matthew 21, remember? He talked about the stone which the builders rejected. They've already heard this prophecy before. Peter's not going to let them off the hook. He says, "You're the guilty builders that rejected the stone." So Jay captured that, didn't he, in terms of making sure that that critical word "you" in verse 11 was given an emphasis. But notice that he didn't say, "This is the stone which was set at naught of you, builders," because that wouldn't be right, would it? That would be to overemphasize and to miss the flow of the passage. So, well read in terms of capturing that dramatic point of verse 11. Yes. That's right. Yep, absolutely. And of course, what's going to happen is that's going to go all the way back to Acts 2, verse 21. Whosoever shall call upon the name of... Now, who is it? The name of Yahweh shall be saved, because it's quoting from Joel chapter 2. But the name of Yahweh is then going to become, in Acts 2, verse 38, the name of Jesus Christ. Acts 3, verse 6, the name of Jesus Christ. Acts 3, verse 16, his name. And now, and Jay was given a passage to read where we've got the name in verse 7, the name in verse 10, the name in verse 12, and he captured that. And so there's a little inflection on the word name because it's a key word. And it's going to be a key word through these early Acts of the Apostles. Verse 18 again, verse 30 again of Acts chapter 4. The name, the name, the name, the name of Christ, which in turn is the name of the Lord that they must call upon to be saved. That this one is Yahweh manifest in the flesh, and through him salvation comes. So yes, I think that was a good capture of Jay, of that significant word just woven there as a trilogy in those verses as it turned out. But you want to notice that when you're reading that, don't you? To capture that. Any other comments about Jay's reading? Yes.
I think you did an excellent job at capturing the contest here between, you've got the ideas that were brought out in the first class about the spirit and the flesh, and the challenge that's put towards these rulers who should have been the spiritual leaders of the people and weren't. And Jay captured that challenge, I think, very nicely.
Yep, so in another format, it's red line versus blue line controversy going on. And the tragedy is it's a blue line, red line controversy within Israel between those who ought to be the spiritual leaders and those that are the spiritual leaders of the ecclesia of the new order. And did you notice also the way Jay read, and this is a really tricky thing to do, but I thought that he did well, is that when he started in verse 7, there was sufficient, almost a sense of interrogation in the reading of that verse, which is exactly how it should sound, because the rulers are putting the apostles on trial. And so, by what power or by what name? And you see, so you wouldn't read, by what power or by what name have you done this? No. It's interrogative, isn't it? There's got to be a sense of interrogation going on in the emphasis. So I think Jay captured that. And then did you notice in his response, speaking on behalf of Peter, verse 8, filled with the Holy Spirit, he said, and you could always hear this, ye rulers. Could you hear that? You could always hear a slight echo in his words, which is what you'd expect if Peter is speaking and the words are echoing out to an audience. And it wasn't just to the rulers, was it? Because he was going to say, verse 10, be it known unto you all and to all the people of Israel. They're all assembled there, aren't they? And that slight sense of an echo was a clever way of suggesting that people, that Peter is speaking to an audience. Did you pick that up? That's good reading. Isn't it? That's thoughtful reading. How do you do that? Capture an echo in your voice, as if you're addressing an audience out in a wide, you know, in a wide expanse of space there. And yet, that type of reading helps to capture what's actually going on here. That scene. You felt as if you were in that scene, in that moment of controversy. Now, that's what a good reading does. Did we look up any Greek words? No. Any other comments on that reading?
Right.
Yes, sorry, Jesse.
Yep. In verse 13, it narrates that this was done with boldness, and when all the absolutes of the section that Jay was reading were spoken, there was a sense of confidence. These were truths, so it was really helpful.
Yeah, I think if I was to use one word with regard to the way Jay read, at least the Peter passage, the Peter section, I would have said he adopted a ringing tone. And I mean by that ringing with authority and ringing with sound because of the context in which he was speaking to the audience. So that was, I would say, a very authentic reading of that particular situation envisaged in this very passage. So good example of how reading can bring a passage alive. You know, when a good reader reads a passage, have you ever had a situation in your meeting where a brother stood up and read a passage and you thought, wow, we don't even need an exhortation. That passage has just been brought to life. I've never seen it before. And suddenly, a good reader can do that. They bring it to life. That's why it's the beginnings of good Bible study. Thanks for that, Jay. Excellent. Yes.
I find this sometimes, I'm sure we all like highlight words. One of the things that I find tricky is when you highlight a lot, it can become a hindrance to your public reading. At least that's what I find. So one of the ones I missed is in verse 10, because when you look at everything that's happening here, the standing again of this lame man is to prove the standing again of the Son of God who sits at the right hand. So when you look at a verse like verse 10, where it says, Jesus Christ of Nazareth, whom ye crucified, whom God raised from the dead, even by him doth this man stand before you whole. So there's a connection there too. Mm. But sometimes you can overemphasize, and I find that sometimes I'll do that when I'm reading. You can try and emphasize everything, and
yep.
it can make it less clear.
And it is a judgment call.
Yeah.
But if someone read this, verse 10, be it known unto you all and to all the people of Israel that by the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, whom he crucified, whom God raised from the dead, even by him doth this man stand before you whole. That would capture that, wouldn't it? Even by him doth this man stand, and the point of the stand here is that man stands because this man has stood. So I would have said that you would be absolutely entitled to give that emphasis, and that would have added to the value of the reading. You would have said, wow, that's a really good connection. This man physically is resurrected because this man was literally resurrected. Yep. All right, you get to choose the next reading. And so we'll move to that group there. So prepare yourself for who's going to be reader. We're sort of going to be running short of time here, but I think if we try and get another couple done, it would be good. So you get to choose the reading. Do you have a... Oh, cracker. Cracker of a reading. Whoa, that's a beauty. So Genesis 45. Now, you wouldn't say this is dramatic, would you, Ted?
A different type of dramatic.
Okay, yeah, it is dramatic, but in a different way. And so if you dramatize it the wrong way, then it would be unhelpful. Now, that puts pressure on the reader, doesn't it? Have you cast lots for the reader? It's interesting how everyone's extremely gracious in such situations. No, 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 please. Please be my guest. No, no, no. No, no. I prefer you. Let each esteem other better than self. That's right. Okay, so here we go. Gentlemen, I beg your esteemed attention to our next reader. So just a couple of minutes to allow you the chance to read the passage and to absorb, and I'll give him the key word, shall I? No, I won't give you the key.
From Genesis 45, the first five verses. Then Joseph could not refrain himself before all them that stood by him, and he cried, "Cause every man to go out from me." And there stood no man with him, while Joseph made himself known unto his brethren. And he wept aloud, and the Egyptians and the house of Pharaoh heard. And Joseph said unto his brethren, "I am Joseph. Doth my father yet live?" And his brethren could not answer him, for they were troubled at his presence. And Joseph said unto his brethren, "Come near to me, I pray you." And they came near. And he said, "I am Joseph, your brother, whom ye sold into Egypt. Now therefore be not grieved, nor angry with yourselves, that ye sold me hither, for God did send me before you preserve life."
Who thinks that's an easy passage to read? Good. I'm pleased no hands went up, and I'm sure that our reader felt the same, is it's not an easy passage to read. Now, why is it not an easy passage to read? Because it's not actually a passage of drama so much as a passage of emotion and pathos. And emotion and pathos are very difficult to read. And one of the reasons why they're difficult to read is for this reason, is that, you know, for lots of things in life, if you haven't been there, you don't know. Do you know what the difference is between sympathy and empathy? Sympathy is when you say to a person, "I'm really sorry to hear what's happened to you." Empathy is when you say, "I know exactly how you feel." you can show sympathy to anybody. You can't show empathy unless you've been on that journey. And actually, very few of us could say we've been on Joseph's journey, being sold by one's family into exile and into prison and into loneliness and into despair, and then to have his astonishing spirit that when he reveals himself to his brethren, he focuses on the work of God to preserve their lives through his instrumentality, which was an astounding spirit of humility and God manifestation. And so this is not an easy passage to read, is it? Because it's full of emotion and pathos. And you could overdo it, couldn't you? You could overcook it. But you could also undercook it. So it's a question of trying to, you know, again, tread the balance. So this is a bit of a personal question, but I'm going to ask. So did you feel that you read with emphasis from your perspective? Now, as an audience, did you feel that he read with emphasis? Now, hopefully you'll say yes. But I'll now give you a second question. Do you think he could give more? Could have given more emphasis? Hands up those that think he could give more emphasis. I'm saying this for a reason. Is, do you know, by the way, we've done this very exercise in School of the Prophets in New Zealand, and I'll tell you what was interesting, is that most of us are a bit reluctant to emphasize too much, because people might think, oh, well, you know, who does he, you know. And yet the reality was that when most people read, and you ask the audience, could they do more? The audience said, yes, they could. And the reader said, oh, you really think so? I could be all right to emphasize more? So we often feel a bit reluctant to emphasize what we think is too much, only to find that the audience says, no, you could have done more. So I'm taking that as a positive thing here, is if you felt that you were in danger of overdoing it, don't, because most people wouldn't have thought you overdid it. And in fact, often there's room to do more than we tend to personally think that we should have done. Does that make sense? And I guess it's because at the moment we're all on the platform and people are listening to us. You sort of, somehow we go into a mode of consciousness that says, I better not overdo it, I better not overdo it, I better not overdo it. And of course, this is one of the hardest passages where there's emotion involved. So any specific comments now about this reading that anyone would like to make? Yes.
I think the one area where he maybe could have been more is verse 3 where he says, I am Joseph, because he's been weeping already.
Yep.
So I think that would have almost been with a broken voice when he said, I am Joseph,
yep,
when he reveals himself. And the other comment I had, verse 5, he did a good job there of saying, for God did send me before you to preserve life. So he brings out the fact that God was...
He saw it as providential. Yeah, and so emphasizing that word God correctly drew attention, it was a good emphasis, wasn't it? Drew attention to the providential aspect of the whole thing, and that the Joseph was actually sufficiently exalted in spirit to see it as that way. Despite all the distress that he himself had endured, he saw the hand of the Father working in that. So you're quite right. So here's the drama of the moment. So verse 2 says he weeps aloud. And presumably weeping is weeping. You don't weep in Egyptian as opposed to weeping in Hebrew. You simply weep. But don't forget that up till now, when he said in verse 1, cause every man to go out from me, in what language was that uttered? Egyptian. So he says something which probably his brothers didn't understand, but what they did know is that whatever it was, the servants understood, because they all vamoosed out of the door and shut the door. And then they probably thought, oh, now we're for it, because... You get this sort of, this Hebrew tongue being rattled off. The servants all disappear. The doors are shut. Now they're left alone with this man who they're already pretty spooked by. And suddenly he bursts into tears. And they think, what is going on here? And then he says, I am Joseph. And he must have still been crying, don't you think? But he said it in Hebrew. Now, if they were spooked before, this would have actually spooked the living daylights out of them. When this weeping Egyptian says in Hebrew, I'm Joseph. And no wonder the margin says the brethren could not answer him, for they were troubled at his presence. Troubled, the margin says, they were terrified. absolutely terrified, because they'd gone from this Egyptian ruler being in charge of their lives to suddenly this being their brother. It was just like, you know. It was just such a mind-wrenching change. And then he says, verse 4, come near. They were terrified. So somehow, you've got to capture that in the reading, the sense of terror on the part of the brothers, and a complete, I think, by the way, complete loss of emotional control by Joseph. How long has he been waiting for this moment? How long has he been waiting for that moment of discovery? 22 years. Now, that's really hard to read. But if you then said, could he have given more emphasis? Yeah. And would he have damaged the meaning of the passage by emphasizing a little bit more? No, but it could take that, couldn't it? So the good thing to remember is that most of us tend to underemphasize when we're reading publicly because we imagine that people think we're emphasizing too much. And in most cases, you could do more and feel comfortable doing more as far as the audience is concerned. Would that be a fair observation in terms of that reading? Amazing reading, isn't it? Sorry, some comments from the floor. So, John, first of all. Yep.
This is a great opportunity as well to use silence during that time to kind of emphasize, because it's very tactile. You know, there's a lot of emotion in the air. And when he says, you know, I'm Joseph, how's my father? You know, but from there, Brother's point, they're so terrified, they're not saying anything, there's just silence. Hmm. You know, and it's pregnant pause. You know, it's long. And Joseph, again, has to take control of the situation by, you know, ushering them closer to him. So you kind of use that whole silence to show, you know, just yep. how awkward but how powerful, you know, it was all at the same time.
Mm. Mm. I absolutely agree that a silence between verses 3 and 4, long enough to just feel the prickling of it, would be a really good thing to insert into that reading. Pauses in readings are very, very good. That's part of emphasis. Good pause. So, yeah. David, do you have a comment?
Yeah, it leads into my comment. I thought Brother Nathan treated the semicolons and colons well.
Ah, those non-inspired commas and colons.
Yes.
He treated them well.
I wonder if I might have inserted about 4 or 5 semicolons after I am Joseph.
Colon, 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 colon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you have all those colons in your version?
No, no. As he states that, you wouldn't want to ask the second question, which he really wanted to know.
Mm.
He wasn't just saying it. He wanted an answer to that question. And it would be lost if you just said, I am Joseph, as my father yet alive.
That's right. So think of the pause. I am Joseph. Doth my father yet live? Pause between those two. Yep. And now they've each got the measure of them, and his brethren could not answer him. That would be, by the way, I'm always very reluctant to use the marginal references, but I think sometimes they can be good, and I would be sorely tempted if I was doing that reading to use that word terrified from the margin, simply because on this occasion I think it's so exactly, whereas the word troubled is perhaps a bit too gentle, don't you think? Terrified's good. Yeah. It's how you feel when you come up here to do the next reading. Thank you for that reading. Yep. And now you get to choose. Okay, I think one more, and then we better call it quits because the cup of tea will be getting cold. But let's just do one more for our learned gentleman sitting in front of you, the doyens of the school. So did you have a reading, gentlemen? Numbers. Sorry? Ooh. Numbers 25, 6 to 9. Thank you. Well, if the previous reading was pathos, what would you say this reading's about? All right, shall we accept that that comment? So the overriding theme is zeal, the zeal of Phineas. All right, you all ready? So Numbers 25.
And behold, one of the children of Israel came and brought unto his brethren a Midianitish woman in the sight of Moses, and in the sight of all the congregation of the children of Israel who were weeping before the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. And when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, saw it, he rose up from among the congregation and took a javelin in his hand, and he went after the man of Israel into the tent and thrust both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman, through her belly. So the plague was stayed from the children of Israel, and those that died in the plague were 24,000.
Dum-da-dum, dum-da. So would this be a dramatic reading? Yes, definitely a dramatic reading, as well as needing emphasis. So what do you think the key point of the reading is? That someone took action. Interestingly enough, Moses didn't. Did you notice that? Mm. But Phinehas did. Yes?
I thought John did a good job of emphasizing the horror of the situation as well in introducing it, the first couple of verses there, the first verse.
There was a sense of shock in his tone that it was in the sight of Moses and in the sight of all the congregation of the children of Israel. And they're two separate things, aren't they? In the one case, in front of the whole congregation is about the brazen defiance of what was happening. And what do you think it means in the sight of Moses? What do you think the point of that would be? That in the face of Moses, the lawgiver, Yahweh's lawgiver, to do that in the presence of Moses was just incomprehensible in terms of its defiance, you know, to do such a thing. Yes?
Yeah, I don't think you can, I think John did a good job of it. Looking at the read verse, halfway through verse 7, down to halfway through verse 8, I think it should speed up, it's like a crescendo.
Yes, understood. And in order to do that, and I think that John brought this out, is you would deliberately want to start that slowly so that you could build the momentum. And so verse 7 would be, and I think this is how John did read it, and when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, and I would make sure I had that, the priest saw it. Who in the end took control of the situation? Who pursued the holiness of Yahweh in this matter? The priest of God, the priest which was for to come, Phinehas. So, but you could be measured with that, couldn't you? Because this three generations. And when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he, and now you've got Richard's sense of, now the momentum begins. He rose up from among the congregation, he took a javelin in his hand, and he went after the man of Israel. Now, you've got to be careful, otherwise you'll end up at such a gallop at the other end. But you would want to do that, because then what happens is this. And so he thrust both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman through her belly, and now notice what happens. And so the plague was stayed from the children of Israel. And what you would do now is drop it all the way back again, wouldn't you? It's all over now. And you'd want to symbolize that by now slowing the entire momentum of your reading down, and so the plague was stayed. You wouldn't say, and so the plague was stayed from all the children of Israel. No. That's not how you read it. That's the wrong emphasis, isn't it? So again, this was, notice how the groups have all delighted in presenting difficult readings for our readers, right? So they've been real tests of fortitude and courage by the readers. And we thank all of our readers for tonight, because I know what it's like putting up on the platform. You know, it ain't really what you want to do. And you do have a terrible sense of being conscious as you stand up there. But these have all been very good illustrations, haven't they, of how emphasis can add so much to that reading. So any other comments before John sneaks off, because he looks like he's in the danger of doing that. So, Tim.
Just in respect to all of them, it's a good reminder, sort of as a corollary to our reading for Bible study, but also for one we're presiding. These four brethren have had 30 seconds to prepare for the reading.
Absolutely. So now that's an interesting observation, because I wasn't aware of that. So in our meeting, in our ecclesial handbook, the presiding brother, the exhorting brother, and the reading brothers are down in the program for the entire year for the reading portions. So you don't have that in your handbook?
Some do.
We have the first reading, not necessarily the second.
Okay. So